This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
I'm a broadcaster by long standing and an academic by briefly and almost fraudulently. So forgive me in this illustrious company if sometimes I appear to skate over some interesting things. I'm also very much addressing issues that are relevant to me as a broadcaster. So if you found discussions of, as anthropologists, discussions of botany arcane, wait till you hear this. The other thing I want to say is the ABC has been, it has woven its way through this in interesting ways, and Martin refers in his introduction on to his own paper in the catalogue to the fact that his exposure to this expedition came through listening to the documentary which I'm addressing. Likewise, Bill Honey Jr. is here. Bill Honey Sr. was the guide on the thing as you, on the expedition, as you know, and Honey became deeply implicated or wound into the ABC's the history of, that I'm addressing, in the sense that he became very good friends with John Thompson. John Thompson was the producer of the series in which this expedition appears. John Thompson, of course, is the adopted father of Jack Thompson, who will be speaking to us tonight, and so on and so on. That through this, I feel that the ABC has, for all sorts of reasons, finds itself wound into this. I also want to apologise. There's no buffalo hunt in this. I had promised in my abstract a buffalo hunt, but I dropped the buffalo hunt. We're going to stick with the birds. Just a brief word too on the method. What I've considered myself, if you like, as a kind of archaeologist, and the archaeology concerns the objects which are old 78 recordings, and this archaeological dig which I'm about to perform, or take you through some of my dig, is one of three digs I undertook on some quite serendipitously discovered 78 RPM discs. So it's that's the method, if you like. On January the 18th, 1949, in the Australian Walkabout slot on the ABC's on the ABC, they broadcast a documentary feature built upon factual happenings of yesterday and today called Expedition to Arnhem Land. The first broadcast was on November 30th, 1948. The feature was produced by John Thompson and was written and presented by Colin Simpson, whom we've heard already, who, as you heard yesterday, spent a fortnight in September-October 1948 at the Owen Pelly base camp of the expedition. Simpson was accompanied on his Arnhem Land foray by PMG sound technician Ray Giles. The recording labelled Bird Life on a Swamp on Arnhem Land, was with which this presentation is about to begin, is one of the many field recordings made by Giles under Simpson's direction whilst the duo were up north, and was through this recording that I initially began to sound the expedition to Arnhem Land, a radio documentary feature which is emerges at a critical moment in Australian media and cultural history. So just listen to a little bit of that. So this is the sound you've been listening to and part of before. That recording that you can see there is the field recording transferred from wire tape to that disc and cut by EMI. And that appears in our sound effects collection. And it's a remarkable recording because I think it's the first actuality environmental sound recording that made its way into a radio program in this country. In his 1951 book about the expedition and his encounters with Aboriginal culture more broadly, Adam in Ochre, Simpson comments extensively upon the recordings he and Giles made for the ABC. So we have these three texts, field recording, which you can see there and heard a little bit of, the documentary feature, which is up on the NMA's website, and which we'll be hearing a fragment of, and the book. We can, in effect, triangulate Simpson's voice literally and figuratively, and map it onto the mediascape of 1948 to 1951, we can hear or read Simpson's voice in different contradictory modalities: independent writer and state broadcaster, my contradictions as well, and trace the differing authority accorded these distinct textual modalities: the real physical voice, recorded sound, and the written word. In its publicity, the ABC described Expedition to Arnhem Land as the authentic story of the Mountford Expedition. The documentary went to air, as I said earlier, in the Australian Walkabout program. The first edition of Australian Walkabout was broadcast on May 15, 1947. It preceded the introduction of the ABC's news service by 2 weeks. A full-page advertisement for the Australian Walkabout in the June 22, 1947 edition of the ABC Weekly runs with the copy, "Meet old pioneers, hear actual voices of Australian personalities, hear exciting incidents from Australia's past and present." Now, that's a line to sell things. The stated objectives of Australian Walkabout was to portray the life and history of important Australian towns and districts against the background of national development. That will sound familiar from Kim Beazley's presentation yesterday. The ABC was at pains to assure listeners that the greatest care was taken to see that every detail was authentic, the material gathered at first hand by the special writers concerned. I'm not going to unpack the idea of authenticity particularly here, but I do want to talk a little bit about Walkabout. But first, I will say, in terms of Colin Simpson, he was a man much concerned with authenticity. And for those of you of a literary frame of mind, be interested to know that Simpson was the journalist who exposed the Ern Malley hoax in the Sydney Sun in 1944. He was editor of the Sydney Sun's supplement Fact. And so the idea of this special writer and his relationship to authenticity is critical. Today the term walkabout seems to be used by outback tour operators and describing the brief forays of the Queen to meet the people. While it may well be the case that to go walkabout has lost much of its racist or disparaging overtones applied to Aboriginal people today, it would seem at best archaic. The Macquarie Dictionary definition makes explicit the conflicts between white Australian culture and Aboriginal ways of knowing, describing walkabout as, quote, "a period of wandering as a nomad, often as undertaken by Aborigines who feel the need to leave the place where they are in contact with white society and return for spiritual refreshment to their traditional way of life." Going walkabout, then, was seen as an expression of authentic Aboriginal culture, if albeit a problematic one. In its vernacular use by white Australia, the idea of going walkabout acquired a set of seductive and subversive meanings. Loading up the station wagon with swag and billy, suburban man and his family leave the bitumen and head off out back. Several weeks, maybe several months later, our happy wanderers return from this unstructured journey into the interior more knowledgeable, more at home with our country and with themselves, spiritually refreshed. So while there are numerous cartoons in the 40s, 50s and 60s, I'm sure you'll remember them, that depicted shifty blacks slinking back from walkabout, the word was affixed as a title to magazines, books and films all through that period, with the connotation of journeying beyond the civilised world, travelling overland into knowledge. In choosing to name their new program Australian Walkabout, Colin Simpson and John Thompson, both special writers who formed the ABC's features unit, would have been aware of these nuanced ambiguities. Indeed, the advertisement referred to earlier uses the image of the swagman as its logo. The swaggy is the white Australian on perpetual walkabout, restlessly on the move, avoiding settlement, shy of regular work. As a symbol of intractable independence, the swagman is a peculiarly Australian figure, entering national mythology via a song that has him stealing a sheep and, to avoid punishment, drowning himself. As he's depicted in the advertisement for Walkabout, the swaggy, waltzing his Matilda, humping his bluey along country roads, is a nostalgic figure, a relic from the days of the gold rushers and pioneers. At the same time, it's difficult to imagine that Simpson and Thompson would not also have been familiar with a more recent and less romantic image of the itinerant, the many thousands of men and women who took to the road on the Wallaby in search of work during the Great Depression. The portability and reliability of recording equipment in the immediate post-war years enabled the program maker to not simply get out of the studio, they'd been doing that for years, but to venture forth into remote places with relative ease. The idea of reporting the richness and complexity of life in the wide brown land obviously met with the ABC's sense of high national purpose and an invigorated sense of national development, especially of the remote and sparsely populated north in the aftermath of the Pacific War, as Kim Beazley elaborated yesterday. But there is also, I suspect, a hint of romance and subversion in calling this roving features program Australian Walkabout. One of the implications of getting out and about is that we will hear the unruly voices of ordinary Australians talking about their extraordinary, ordinary lives. But the Commission assures us every detail is authentic. The risks of going walkabout could only be justified by the resulting program's claim to authenticity. Listeners could be assured, however, that not a lot of wild talk would be allowed to leak out of the wire. After all, ABC announcers still wore evening dress, and speaking proper was all the go. Pass it up with a dangerous suggestion of feral authenticity is an ambiguous gesture towards the Indigenous, partly a recuperation of the Aboriginal need to walk the land into being, and partly a new claim made on behalf of white Australia to share this ancient nomadic way of knowing, to appropriate or at least partake of authenticity through the act of recording, that we might go walkabout with the Australian Broadcasting Commission in the services of national development further complicates the picture. And I'd like you just to listen to the introduction to the program. They don't do grand anymore on the ABC.
Expedition to Arnhem Land, an ABC feature program. Like that Aboriginal song man and the didgeridoo, most of this feature was recorded in Arnhem Land, in tents or beside a lagoon alive with birds at dawn, and sometimes with nothing between the speakers and the stars except mosquitoes. The ABC sent Colin Simpson and a technician with a portable recorder to Owen Pelly, 140 miles from Darwin, near the East Alligator River. They spent 2 weeks with the expedition of American and Australian scientists led by Mr. C.P. Mountford. Here is a first-hand, not too formal, account of what the scientists did and what they discovered in that little-known top corner of the Northern Territory from which the Arnhem Land expedition has just returned after 8 months in the field. And here is Colin Simpson.
Arnhem Land is like no other part of Australia I've seen. At Owen Pelly, the expedition was camped and a green canvas tent beside a beautiful inland lagoon. A big boomerang of shining blue water, fringed with emerald green grass and decorated right down the middle with water lilies. On the other side of this lovely lagoon or billabong rose Inyalak, a great hill of rugged sandstone and quartzite, full of caves of Aboriginal rock paintings in ochre colours and kangaroo blood. Back on this side, up past the tents, the expedition's cookhouse butted onto the stockyards of Owen Pelly Mission. Beyond the tin gunyahs of some mission natives, out past the small airstrip where we landed in from Darwin, lie plains, savannas of wild rice and speargrass where the buffaloes graze. It is late afternoon of a burningly hot day. To the east, a plateau of stone country is softened with purple haze. Down at the far end of the lagoon, natives are gathering lily roots to eat and hand-netting fish. And in the middle foreground of this picture are 14 male members of the expedition, bathing. From wearing only shorts in the sun, they're copper brown to the waist. But here they're wearing nothing except beards. I'm going to pick out the expedition leader. He's one of the clean-shaven minority, and go with Mr. C.P. Mountford back to his tent. Now he is dressed in khaki shirt and long trousers this time against the evening's mosquitoes. His white solar topi is set aside for the day. And I'm asking Mr. Mountford how this expedition to Arnhem Land came about.
Well, it happened this way. During 1944, I was sent across to the United States of America by the Department of Information to lecture on two coloured films I had made of Aboriginal life from the western deserts of Central Australia. During the course of my lectures, I spoke before a large audience of the National Geographic Society at Washington. This so interested that society that they finally appointed me the leader of a small party to visit Arnhem Land. That party to consist of no more than an American biologist and myself. When I returned to Australia, Mr. Corwell, the Minister for Information, became most interested in the expedition.
Mountford's response to Simpson's question is almost certainly read, is to read a prepared statement, in which he outlines a scientific brief of the expedition and its explicit nature as a government-backed venture, financed at least in part by the Department of Information. This read response to an interview question sounds not quite right to the contemporary ear, and it's the first indication of the disjunct between speech and writing, between recording and writing, that I wish to explore in some more detail. The greatest care was taken to see that every detail was authentic, the material gathered at first hand by the special writers concerned. September 1948 finds Colin Simpson, our special writer, portable wire recorder in tow and notebook in hand, finally out of the office, on walkabout. He's in the service of the Australian Broadcasting Commission, attached to an international scientific expedition, the composition of which is an expression of the new post-war relationship with the United States. Every detail must be authentic. Clearly, this authenticity depends upon the presence of the special writer, a reliable witness, an authority. What role, then, for sound recording in expedition to Arnhem Land? There's no single answer to that question, rather a set of conflicted relationships between writing and sound recording, between writer and speaker, which are present all the way through the opening moments. I want to just have one last moment to unpack one final moment for him. We've heard him introduce the expedition on air. But this is how he introduces it in his writing, in the book. In the lagoon at evening, when the last glow of the sun made satin of the water and the wind stood still, was the day's best hour. Down there at the big billabong mirroring Inyalak, shared with the natives and the near birds no one turned to hunt, there was a feeling of being part of a quest that was wider and more real than anything you could seek for in a city. And there was no sense of urgency and need or time. There was a balm and essence I have not felt before or since. Others felt it too. I remember Bob Miller standing out there in the quiet water the evening before he had to leave Owen Pelly and return to America saying, "This I'm going to miss a great deal." A tropical evening, the company of honest men and the companionship of unsullied natives, more real than anything you could seek for in a city, a quest, a balm, an essence. This is Eden both invoked and evoked at a time when, as the Sydney Morning Herald had it, Arnhem Land bore a sinister reputation and was shunned by white men except for a few buffalo hunters, traders, missionaries and patrol officers and anthropologists. Simpson is equally romantic but more sentimental as he too seeks to instruct his primarily white urban readers in their own inauthenticity. Adam N. Oker recounts a personal journey which at least suggests the possibility of individual redemption or recuperation of an authentic being. So the recording that we hear, opening there, which he incorporates later on into the program, stands as a way, as a kind of souvenir for Simpson's own lost sense of authenticity as he sullies himself by becoming a spokesperson for the ABC's formal role, almost in service to the Department of Information's larger project. I wanted to skip to the point where I think he pick up on some of that idea to finalise this moment. So we hear Simpson talk about the recording of Bird Life in Arnhem Land, which you just hear then. And there's a radical disjunction between the actual recording and the narrative Simpson weaves around it. Technically, the recording, a wire recording from 1948, cannot convey the auditory richness and depth of Simpson's experience. It will not measure up to his memory. And it is precisely this fundamental inadequacy that defines bird life on a swamp in Arnhem Land, as a souvenir rather than a true record, a document. As Susan Stewart writes, the souvenir must remain impoverished and partial so that it can be supplemented by a narrative discourse which articulates the play of desire without which it would not function, that both attaches to its origins and creates a myth with regard to those origins. Stewart then goes on to argue that the nostalgia of the souvenir plays in the distance between the present and an imagined prelapsarian experience, experiences that might be directly lived. The location of authenticity becomes whatever is distant to the present time and space. Hence, we can see the souvenir as attached to the antique and the exotic. Notionally included to illustrate the prolific nature of the bird life in Arnhem Land, the recording functions as a souvenir of Arnhem Land's prelapsarian state for Colin Simpson, but also the impossibility of Simpson's return to that state, figuratively and literally. Thank you.
Peter's very anxious to be first in, and I dare not disappoint him. So thanks, Peter.
No, thanks, Margot, and thank you, Tony. That was very stimulating indeed. I'm Peter Stanley from the National Museum. Tony, I was very struck by a couple of things you mentioned. You said that in the course of Simpson's account, he talked about being among unsullied natives, and by that I assume he meant traditional Indigenous communities, which we've heard so much about the last couple of days. But he also talked about being near the tin gunyahs of mission natives. And I suddenly thought to myself, is there something going on here that the expedition is not revealing? Now, I might be drawing too long a bow here, but I'd be very interested in other people's responses, and especially yours. But is it the case that the expedition focused upon traditional Indigenous culture and overlooked, ignored, or didn't take account of other Indigenous experience in Arnhem Land? Were there other Indigenous people in Arnhem Land that the expedition overlooked? And does Simpson reflect upon this?
I think yesterday there was a quote, I can't remember whether Martin gave it or not, but about in which Simpson talks about a group of old men coming that he meets who are wearing cast-off clothes and look, you know, he says, not much can come of this, I think is the actual word. And then later he hears them singing and he is transformed in his idea of who these people are. So in a sense it comes back to the point that Sally, maybe it was a quote from Sally, that Sally made and to which Craddock was referring, that the surprise, and Simpson takes it up really, the expectation of seeing people in a broken state, and the surprise and passion which he recognises and takes up the cultural intensity, the cultural integrity that he encounters. So that's certainly very present in Adam and Oka, which for all its romanticism, and it is very romantic, very sentimental, nonetheless is passionate in its development of the idea that there was a powerful culture that needed to be respected and understood.
Right, thank you.
Okay, one more.
Yes, Linda Barwick. Tony, I thought that was a really excellent unpacking of some of the cultural context of the recording. There's one disjuncture that has always worried me a little about this, and that is the lack of acknowledgement for Ray Giles, the sound recordist, and the contributions that he made, to the extent that the published recordings come out under Simpson's name. And I just wondered if you had some comment on that.
I mean, the comment is a simple one. It's ABC practice of long-standing at the time. I mean, at the time there was a very... I joined the ABC in 84 and it was just on its last legs then, but certainly in the 40s, producers were the... writers were the creative named people. Technicians were employed from the P&G, the Postmaster General's Department, who were seconded to the ABC to provide services. And in fact... the producer wasn't allowed to touch the equipment. The technician did that, but the cost of that was the technician was relegated to invisibility and audibility. Martin has restored some of that with his documentary about the return of the repatriation of those recordings in which you interviewed Ray Giles. But yes, it's quite true.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.